The Spectator magazine combines incisive political analysis with books and arts reviews of unrivaled authority. Subscribe today for just £12 and receive a 12-week subscription in print and online, plus a £20 Amazon gift voucher, absolutely free. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.
Hello and welcome to a special Saturday edition of Coffeehouse Shots. I'm Katie Balls and I'm joined by Fraser Nelson and Kate Andrews. The decision on June 21st is looming, with Boris Johnson to announce his plan on Monday. So what will he decide? The mood music isn't too good for those hoping for a lockdown easing. With 8,125 cases recorded on Friday, there's much talk amongst scientific advisers that it has to be delayed for 2 to 4 weeks. So what's going on? Kate, you write the daily COVID email. What's your prediction?
Ooh, well, if I'm really forced to make a prediction, I suppose I would just have to look at what's happened so far over the past 15 months and say that it's not too good. The government is acting in an extremely cautious way. It's very, very nervous about taking any risk at this point. And it does seem, as you said, Katie, like the mood music would suggest some kind of delay. But as you point out in your fabulous blog, Katie, on Coffee House Now, there are multiple ways that they could delay it. So the lesser of two evils, I suppose, is they set a new Freedom Day. Boris Johnson says 2 to 4 weeks, ideally two. We just want to get more second jabs into the arms of the most vulnerable, and then we're going to open regardless of what the infection data is showing. The, I think, far worst case scenario is one where he says we are going to postpone for at least 2 to 4 weeks, and then we're going to look at the data again. Because the question, Katie, one that the government has never answered in the 15 months that this pandemic has been going on, is really what data they're actually looking at. If they're looking at hospitalizations and deaths, at the moment, there's a lot of reason to be positive. Hospitalizations are still almost 97% below their peak, deaths 99%. What we saw in Bolton, where the Indian variant hit hard, is that hospitalizations did plateau, and that the vast majority of infections were in the younger age groups, where people are a lot less likely to get sick. But it does seem that they've pivoted to looking at infection data, and the R rate is thought to be well above one now. As we unlock, we know infections are going to go up. The question is, do you have faith in the vaccines? And frankly, the rhetoric from this government for months now has been playing that down very often, because they want people to follow the rules. But if they're not going to have faith in the vaccines, then we may not see a meaningful reopening this summer, and then you're getting into the winter time when we're already talking about more restrictions. The huge caveat here is we always know that the data could change, right? And if you did start seeing a meaningful spike in hospitalizations, we'd have a lot of problems on our hands, not just capacity in the NHS, but questions around the vaccine itself. But if the vaccine does hold up, as we suspect, hopefully it will, there are certainly going to be questions for the government to answer about why they're still restricting our freedoms.
Fraser, if we go for Kate's worst case scenario, that the government announced a 4-week delay and say they're going to keep checking the data, how do you feel? Because you've written in the past about lockdown restrictions and questioning them. But recently in the Spectator office, you've been having perhaps a more positive take on restrictions.
Well, because you guys have been so bleak, and I'm not quite sure I share your pessimism. I mean, let's look around right now. It's a pretty full, vivacious city. I was in the pub last night with Douglas Murray. We walked up to the bar, ordered a pint.
Did you order it from the bar?
We actually did.
I don't think that's in the rules, but keep going.
Right. People were taking a liberal interpretation, shall we say, and I think there's been an outbreak of common sense, actually, amongst public people being respectful, they were being careful. You can see this city returning to life. I'm merely referring to London, of course. This is my adopted city. But, you know, you can go shopping, you can go to restaurants, you can, you know, go in, order a burger, sit down, as I did after I met Douglas. Rather sad figure I must have cut to myself. I hadn't ordered a burger for a while.
And which burger restaurant did you go to?
I went to Five Guys. Do you know how long it takes to serve you in that place? I mean, I would not go back.
Oh, well, that's actually because of a lot of the rules that have been set up and the way that they have to deliver now. Unfortunately, it's almost as if we're not back to normal.
It's not. The thing is, Kate, you talk about like a binary thing, like it's normal or not normal. We are, I don't know what percent back to normal we are. I would say 80 to 85% back to normal. Now, of course, that we know that that it looks as if they're going to lift the restrictions for weddings, which I know is a subject close to your heart, Katie. Now, the thing is, I am not, like, our producer, Cindy Yu, sitting opposite me. I know that she's looking forward to stripping the light fantastique going to nightclubs on the 21st of June. That might not happen. But I will confess to thinking that wouldn't be such a big dent in my personal schedule. I think the way that people look around, you can see the economy is reviving a lot right now. The data is good. Job vacancies are up by something like 30-40%. There are labour market shortages. Salaries are increasing at the fastest rate in quite some time. These are encouraging signs. But the other thing we have to accept is that we are up against a Indian variant, a Delta variant, that is spreading quite quickly. The consensus seems to be that for every person that gets it, we'll pass it on to six others right now if they're susceptible. That is a pretty formidable ratio, a ratio twice as high as it was the first time around. Now, the big question, as you're saying, Kate, is how will this convert into hospitalizations? Right now, the data, as PHE were saying yesterday, is reasonably encouraging. There is something like 900 COVID patients in hospital, which stands against something like 33,000 at the peak. And that figure of 900 is lower than any of the five SAGE scenarios that they outlined at the start of this. So you could look at hospitals and think, what's the problem? Keep going. But we will know a lot more with a couple more weeks' data. So I can see the argument for thinking, let's just wait to see if the relationship between infections, hospitalizations, and deaths is as low as we think. We don't have that much more data on the Delta variant. We saw how it took over in India very, very quickly. It seems to be taking over in this country very, very quickly. There is lots of reasons for optimism, and I share all of those reasons, but I can also see the case for giving it a couple more weeks so we can be absolutely sure. Meanwhile, what are the restrictions on people's lives? Now, I can speak selfishly in saying that I'm not going to be going to many nightclubs. I'm not going to be getting married, though I will hopefully be angling for an invitation to Katie's wedding. But I can, you know, okay, I can't sing in church right now, but, you know, I can't have, my kids can't have parties. There are things which are annoying, but then again, you have to remember that we're still in the middle of an unresolved pandemic. We've done pretty good vaccinating in this country, but still only something like 14% of the under 40s. Are vaccinated. And Philip Thomas, in his cover piece for the magazine this week, says that he, by the way, is by no means a COVID alarmist. His stuff has been pretty centrist. He reckons that on the current figures, then the Delta variant will mean that pretty much every single person who hasn't had COVID or isn't successfully vaccinated against it is about to acquire it, peaking in the middle of June, fizzling out at the end of August. He says he hopes he's too pessimistic. I don't know, but I can see the case for waiting a little bit longer to see.
I suppose two things from that. So first off, Kate, what do you say to Fraser's point, which is actually perhaps a cautious, sensible thing is just to wait a few weeks. It's an idea that appears to court the Chancellor Rishi Sunak's attention. Although he's often billed as a lockdown hawk, it's been briefed to various publications. The Chancellor would be content with 2 to 4 weeks, depending which publication you go with, just to get more of a grip of the data. Can you see the argument in that?
Well, I think if you want to be cautious, you would wait a few more weeks. And that speaks to that first option that you laid out in your blog, Katie, that the Prime Minister sets a new freedom date, makes very clear when he plans to lift restrictions, if we hope to see in the data that hospitalizations remain low. But I don't think we should do that without acknowledging the pain and the sacrifice that goes along with it, even for a few more weeks. Delighted to hear about your pint at the pub with Douglas Murray. To be a fly on the wall for that very sound conversation would be great. But unfortunately, I don't think that does particularly symbol real life, at least not for a lot of us. You can't have proper birthday parties. You can't throw your children parties. You can't meet a stranger at a bar and start to chat. You can't really make new friends right now.
And Douglas and I both got talking to strangers in the park last night. It's quite fun.
Well, it sounds like a great bar.
Yeah, sure, I would love to go to this bar because and I wonder, Fraser, if you spoke to the owner of the bar or perhaps maybe some of the staff behind it, because
I'm pretty chilled.
I haven't found a small business owner, not even after the 17th of May unlocking, who says that things are going great. They are struggling seriously with capacity issues. They're struggling to turn a profit. They're struggling with the councils that don't want them to set up outside. And asking them to wait a few more weeks, or certainly indeed in the worst case scenario, a few more months or into next year, as again, we are already talking about restrictions this autumn, is a huge ask on, you know, it's wonderful for us to sit here and say, well, we can go to a restaurant with a few of our friends. What's so bad? But what happens when those restaurants don't exist anymore? What happens when thousands of businesses go under? What happens when the 4 million people still on furlough are even more likely to find out at the end of this that their jobs no longer exist? It's not to say that the cautious argument is wrong. It's to say that there is a sacrifice being made that has been made for 15 months, and we have not even begun to scrape the surface of all of the other problems: mental health, physical health, undiagnosed cancer treatments, missed opportunities in life, even just that spice of life of meeting somebody new or having a fun, spontaneous experience that has gone out the window.
Okay, correct me if I'm wrong here, but were the two of you not in Portugal last weekend?
Well, that's what I wanted to actually ask, Fraser, because on that...
Sounds pretty spontaneous to me, right?
It wasn't.
But Fraser...
Quite detailed testing.
I was delighted to go abroad, but... There is a column by Kate in The Spectator this week, which is often talking about the fact that what I think she's felt limited by is the option of spontaneity. And actually, yes, you could hang out in a group of six, but if you're, I suppose, a younger person, you don't feel like, as though perhaps you found your partner or your friendship circle is completely complete, that's the kind of interaction you might need. Do you think that ultimately there is a moral case that those people just had to wait a little bit longer?
Look, I completely understand what Kate says. That they're for, if you're a restaurant owner or a bar owner, a whole bunch of companies and organizations right now who are desperate for normal life to resume so they can resume their business, they can even see if they've got a viable business. By the way, I don't think it's all to do with restrictions. I think that I was, just to complete the story of my pub last night, I went there in a black cab. He was saying that most of his business depends on the City of London right now. He's saying that 9/10 of his income, as far as he can work out, depends on financial jobs. And he thinks they won't come back even after the pandemic. They've acquired home working habits that they're not going to lose. Now, that is a really serious issue, but it's not related to the restrictions.
But there is a working from home restriction at the moment.
Sure, there is right at the moment, but when that is all lifted, let's say everything were to be lifted on the 21st of June, you would still find tumbleweed blowing through large sections of Canary Wharf, simply because of the way that companies are... We do not know if cities are ever going to come back as they were before, and that is a big question. That's going to mean misery for lots of people, taxi drivers, bar owners, restaurant owners, anybody who tended to the mass commuting markets that went into these cities is going to be very badly hurt. So I don't think any... I'm not at all saying everything is great. I just think you need to put it in the perspective of the liberties we have now versus the ones that we had in February, for example. And this is the point where I think...
When we had very few at all.
Yes, exactly. And now we have a lot more.
It sounds to me, correct me if I'm wrong, but it sounds like being grateful for being given something as opposed and moving away from the principle that these are extraordinary times in which our freedoms were suspended and we need to get them back fully.
You know, I think we should invite Cindy Yu into our conversation right now. She's narrowing her eyes at me.
Cindy, you're the youngest person in the room.
Sorry, I just had a quick question, Fraser, which is that you say compared to February this year, what about February 2020? Can we compare to that, the freedoms that we have? It sounds like you've got Stockholm Syndrome.
Yeah. We did all sorts of things in the days before there were a pandemic. And remember, right now, I mean, one of the things that has given me pause, I like to think that I have been, throughout this pandemic, on the... My bias has tended to be towards the side of liberty.
Yes, but that's why we're all very confused.
So, but you seem to think I've changed my position. I'm not sure. All the way along, there is a balance. We all know that there's a balance. We all know that there's a reason why the government ordered lockdown. We all know there's a reason for the restrictions. And we also know that we're facing a scenario where we could have far more infections than we did in the peak of January. Right now, we're pretty sure that that will not translate into hospitalizations, but we're not completely sure. It will take us a little bit longer for the data to find that out. I'm thinking that after, I don't know, 15 months, 16 months we've had of these restrictions, waiting another 2 weeks to see how the data goes is not the most irrational thing in the world. And again, let's think of what we're talking about. I completely get the small business point, but for the most people, their liberties have not been particularly curtailed. Now, okay, that you really making eyes at me now, Kate. And but Cindy, you didn't go to nightclubs before this. You didn't. I know you weren't. You're not allowed to now. But you know, has your life, Cindy, really changed that much versus what you were doing in February 2020? To use your analogy,
yes. I'll tell you what I can't do now. I can't go to China, not least because it's China and they won't have me because of their own COVID rules. But I can't go international travelling. I can't go see my family. So even if China did let foreigners in, I couldn't go without having ridiculous tests that Kate has written about in this week's magazine. I can't go to a busy pub where I can have more than six of my friends. And I don't know about you, Fraser, but yeah, exactly, five. But, you know, sometimes that does lead to awkward situations. But of course, for small business owners, it's much more serious and my objections are just social. But I'm also concerned about what this means for the rest of the year. If the vaccines haven't offered us freedom, as Kate says, what happens when autumn comes, when there is a flu season, when any new variant comes? Is this just going to be the new normal that we are literally going to be in this kind of half lockdown for the rest, you know, for the foreseeable few years?
I'm not sure I'd call it half a lockdown. I would say, if you want to put a portion on it, I'd say the lockdown is probably about 20% of what it was earlier on. And Cindy, you're right about foreign travel. I can't go to Sweden to see my in-laws. But that isn't anything to do with this government right now. The government, sure, the government has put countries on the amber list, but if the government were to say to us, you can go wherever you want, we would still face a problem that a great many countries simply wouldn't let us in. I mean, Cindy, it's the Chinese authorities that are stopping you from going back to China, as far as I can work out.
So Fraser and I very much agree that this actually should be a data-driven decision, that you should be looking at the most crucial metrics on hospitalizations and deaths and make your decisions from there. If you want to make the case that we are all still living in a very abnormal world and that we need a few more weeks to decide if we can truly lift it, I do understand. I think you can debate that at the margin, but I understand the case for a bit more caution. You know, everybody in this room understands why certain lockdowns were very necessary to save tens of thousands of lives. The danger zone that we are in right now is that there is a possibility, there are considerations in Whitehall that actually this might take a lot longer than they originally promised, and that they're looking at new data, not the critical data, in order to make those decisions. And if we don't push back on that now, we are going to be looking at a summer possibly that is ironically more restricted than last summer when we didn't have a single working vaccine. Last summer, it was guidance to meet up in an under 30 group, and the law, if you did it over 30, you couldn't meet up in a group over 30. We could be looking at a scenario where into the summer, we are more restricted domestically and certainly internationally. It's much easier to travel abroad last year. As Katie and I learned at the weekend, if you want to go to the one country on the green list that actually would let us in, and then you wanted to come back and it's off now, you were reminded of COVID every single step of the way. It was easier last year. So we're looking at a summer where 80% of the UK adult population has antibodies, where we have jabbed all of the vulnerable in society who want to receive it, and we are the country in the world who wants the vaccination the most. And it could, theoretically, they're having conversations about whether or not this summer should be more restricted than last summer. And Fraser, I hear you that May, June is not February. None of us would say it is. The fact that we can go out and get a pint together if we want to is and somebody else can pour it and that we can pay that person to do so is absolutely delightful.
We had 30 readers in the back garden.
Yes, I mean, yes. And we had it, and we had 30 podcast. We didn't have 30 because that would have been too many, but we had some podcast listeners over and staff. And that was delightful, Fraser, it was. But you know what? Part of living in a free society is that you don't make things illegal for people just because you wouldn't take part in them. You do not know what nightclubs mean to some people. You do not know what having a big birthday party or a big family gathering means to some people. You don't know what the merit of just being able to not be socially distanced at a restaurant where you might meet somebody new, meet a life partner, means to somebody. And in a free society, we think about the minority. And you said people are taking a liberal interpretation. If you go outside a lot of the metropolitan cities, people are still extremely cautious and nervous because they don't have the full details of what's going on. There are a lot of people out there who are still living their lives in a pseudo lockdown form. And we should be thinking about those people because we care about the minority in a free society. And unfortunately, I feel like we have drifted so far from the original intention of saving lives in this process. If you want to wait a few weeks to figure out what the data is doing, I hear you. I think you can make the case, but let's not pretend that there aren't sacrifices being made. every day the longer we wait. And it isn't a few weeks of people's lives. It was 3 weeks at the start of this virus, right? 3 weeks. Now they're asking maybe for another 2 to 3 weeks, but there have been 15 months in between that where our lives have been really curtailed. And we will never know what's been missed from that, but I guarantee it's a heck of a lot. And I think it's very sad, especially for younger people who are just trying to build up their lives.
Look, I would be beside...
Fraser, do you think the goalposts have been moved?
I don't think the goalposts were ever properly fixed. The government might have slightly misled people into thinking that's the case, leading to disappointments. And I think, as Kate was saying earlier, the government has still not said whether it's targeting hospitalisation numbers or cases. But also, the reason which we, on the Spectator Data Hub, every day publish hospitalisations versus the five stage scenarios is to point out that when the 21st of June date was set, there were various scenarios set by Sage, and we're better than every single one of those. I think that still matters. But I also have to accept that what nobody imagined was, well, was sort of, wasn't factored in there, was that right at the last couple of weeks here, we would find the most contagious variant we have seen yet of the virus, still growing exponentially. The R number, as again we track for some Spectator websites, and thanks to Bristol University's research, higher than at any point since we started tracking the R number on a daily basis last summer. And I just think you have to take that into account.
What extent? The R rate's out of the bag now. So if you actually wanted to get the R rate below one again, you would have to have a circuit breaker. You couldn't get the R rate, but we haven't done June 21st yet, and it's well above one. So either we care about infection numbers, or it's not to say we don't, but it's to say either we're going to accept that coming out infections are definitely going up, or we want to keep them very low. But if we want to keep them very low, we would be cutting back on what we've done already.
Oh yeah, and I think the most important thing in Philip Thomas's cover story in the magazine this week is he says that COVID has now been downgraded to be no more lethal than flu. So whatever argument you say about curtailing COVID cases, you could equally apply to flu cases.
Isn't that a really good argument for opening up on the 21st of June?
That is assuming, right now we're assuming that we don't know for sure, but the relationship between new infections, hospitalizations and deaths is as loose as we now think. And I just do see the argument to think, well, look, we didn't think we'd end up in this the final straight here with a virus that's growing exponentially as it now is. It might not take us very long to be sure, to be absolutely sure, but the Indian variant is not translating into the clinical harm which the original variant was. And it's a very difficult balancing situation that always has been from the start. I backed the first lockdown because we didn't know what else was going on and we didn't have many other levers to pull. I backed the current lockdown when it started. I do think it has gone down for too long. I would have sped up this timetable. And I guess...
But you're defending them postponing the 21st of June.
I am saying that it is understandable for them to have concerns about this. And that's all I'm saying. I'm saying that right now it is not completely obvious to me that we should be abolishing all restrictions on the 21st of June. I think there's still a lot more we could learn if we were to give it two more weeks. I'm not saying that I want that to happen. If the Prime Minister does decide, apparently he's going to decide on Sunday, that he's going to abolish all restrictions, I would support that. But similarly, if he were to say, let's wait a couple of weeks, I would see the logic behind that. And I would look around and I would see that our life, our mobility has got significantly, it's not 100% back towards normal, but it's a lot more than it was. And personally, I would factor that in. Now, you think it's just because I had a drink with Douglas Murray and I really enjoyed it? I did. It was great to see Douglas. I haven't seen him for a while. But it's not completely selfish. I think looking at this calculation, I can see the case for caution because nobody else has got the Indian variant as we have. We may well end up as the world capital of the Indian variant. And if that's the case, then Sweden might not be letting me in no matter what Boris Johnson says. China wouldn't be letting Cindy back no matter what Boris Johnson says. You two might have been very wise in nipping off to Portugal while you could at very short notice last weekend. But that will be beyond our control. We don't know yet. There's so much. One thing we do know about COVID is it keeps surprising us. It keeps surprising me. I do think, let's think, vaccine passports, they've been kicked out in touch, as far as I can work out. I was very nervous about the idea of them coming in, about the racial segregation that would cause de facto. As far as I can work out, that isn't happening now. Tony Blair has lost that battle. And perhaps that has made me more relaxed about the whole thing, because one of the things I really did worry about was the construction of the apparatus of a biosecurity state and the discrimination of vaccine passports and the notion of immuno-ID being introduced to this country. I think the Prime Minister successfully fended that off, and right now the stakes are lower than I thought they were when I thought that Michael Gove and Matt Hancock were all set to give us digital ID cards that would restrict our day-to-day life. That would have been, to me, outrageous, and I would have fought that with all the energy in my body. Right now, if we're looking at two more weeks of life carrying on as it currently is, I could live with that.
Fraser, just one quick thing on that, as in, if it's perhaps 4 weeks, and there's a chance, of course, if you look at the past year and a half, it could go further. One of the things that's already murmurs of, and you mentioned vaccine passports, is that we have a situation where the UK had an approach where everyone was going to move in lockstep, but it almost rests on the idea of getting rid of restrictions for everyone. And we're already hearing flicks, I think Tony Blair's back at it today, that if restrictions and the roadmap's not going to go ahead as planned, there are going to be more arguments for double vaccinated people to be able to do more things than either unvaccinated or the single vaccinated. And that's an argument that figures in Whitehall are bracing themselves for if this roadmap is delayed. Does that change your opinion at all?
Yeah, completely. I would be absolutely horrified of the idea of any kind of segregation based on immunological status. I mean, that is a principle. If you let that genie out of the bottle, you'll struggle to get it back in. When you look at the, again, we know that the figures have plateaued for the racial differences, and we know that it's something like 95% for whites, 60% for blacks, and about 80% for South Asians. For as long as those disparities exist, you cannot introduce vaccine-related privileges and not expect it to have severely discriminatory impacts on this country. For that and many, many other reasons, I would bitterly resent that. But I think that Boris Johnson, like, I could have this wrong. I guess I sort of, I can't believe I'm about to say this, trust the Prime Minister to do the right thing.
Kate, do you want to have the final word?
My fear is that for all the optimism that Fraser just put forward, and there's plenty of reason in the data, by the way, that I've already mentioned to be optimistic, if it really were two more weeks to get a few more jabs into arms and then we're reopening, we're willing to acknowledge that we're going to take some level of risk, fine. They have never told us what data they're looking at. They have never been fully transparent about the roadmap itself, because all of the big decisions were left out of the roadmap for consultations led by Michael Gove. They have not been honest with the public throughout this process about where this virus spreads. I mean, the messaging has still been about hands and washing them. We know it's airborne. We know it's really difficult to transmit outside. They asked people to be locked up for months and months and acted like outdoor activity was the same as indoor activity, and we know that it wasn't. They've put people through the ringer, and people were happy to be put through it because all of us really cared about saving the lives of our family and strangers, people we know and don't, because it was the right thing to do. But we have the solution. It is the vaccines. The government continues to talk them down. And I am not as optimistic as Fraser that when they start to push things back, when they have the answer and they don't acknowledge that they have the answer, that we really are going to return to a position that felt like, as Cindy said, February 2020. It's not about comparing it to January, February this year. It's about when we were actually free to do what we wanted to do. And I worry that going into flu season, when the NHS every year has a capacity issue, if something isn't open in August, if something isn't allowed in August, assume it won't be allowed until next year at the earliest. And by the way, we were told that last summer. And the question is, how much longer does this go on for before we start having some more of those difficult conversations? And I would just like to remember those who are struggling throughout this, the physical and mental health issues that have arisen because of it. I don't think delaying by a few weeks is a light decision. Oh, let's see how it goes. I think it has serious impact on countless lives, and we should frame it as such.
Thank you, Kate. Thank you, Fraser. Thank you, Cindy, for your contributions and producing this podcast. And we have a special song to play you out.
Curse off the Zoom. Burst in, we boom. First in the room. 21st of June.
Who's got the bag?
Shooting with my handcuffs.
The Spectator magazine.
Go back to doing what slaps. It's a matter of duty, damn. Fuck the jukebox in the calf. Good God.
Who's got the bag?
Subscribe today for just £12 and receive a 12-week subscription in print and online, plus a £20 Amazon gift voucher, absolutely free. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.